Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, when arts funding and politics collide. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
On this week's show, questions and potential legal action over the politicisation of arts funding as NECAP are denied money by the British government and Arts Council England issues new guidance for anyone thinking about being controversial. But first, Chris, tell me something that stood out for you in the music world this week.
Well, there was one interesting ruling in the German courts of all places, which got us back to the good old-fashioned copyright safe harbour.
Oh, yeah?
Now, regular listeners to Setlist, long-term readers of CMU Daily, will remember a time in the mid-2010s, before the pandemic, before Brexit was a reality, even in some cases before Brexit was a vote, when we used to write an awful lot about the so-called copyright safe harbour. Do you remember the value gap? We used to talk about the value gap, and then didn't it was the record labels that went with value gap, and then didn't the music publishers then go with gap of value or something?
Oh.
So we talked a lot about the copyright safe harbour in the mid-2010s, because of course it became very political with the European Copyright Directive that finally got agreed in 2019, which reformed European copyright law, EU copyright law in the context of digital. And I mean, it did a whole load of things. But from a music industry perspective, certainly for record labels, music publishers, but also artists and songwriters, the safe harbour reform was the thing that people really cared about. And back then, it was all about YouTube. And the allegation that YouTube, I mean, other platforms too, but I mean, it was basically YouTube, wasn't it? So YouTube, this was when the music industry hated YouTube.
Yes.
The allegation was that YouTube et al. Were exploiting this thing called the copyright safe harbour to get unfair preferential rates from the music industry when they were negotiating licensing deals. So there was all this lobbying to change the safe harbour in Europe to increase the obligations specifically of user upload platforms like YouTube. And that went through. Eventually, it was very controversial. YouTube claimed it was going to kill the internet. I mean, it didn't. So they were definitely wrong.
No.
As far as I'm aware, I mean, unless the internet's gone down in the last 10 minutes, and I don't know. Oh, no, we're talking on the internet as we record this podcast.
So we'll know if it goes down.
The internet's definitely working. And so European copyright law changed. The UK then Brexited. So even though the UK music industry lobbied really hard on this, it didn't happen in the UK because by the time it came into force, we were no longer complying with European law. But it has been slowly implemented across the EU over recent years. And it's come up in a case involving TikTok. And it was quite interesting that it was a film company that was suing, utilising the revised safe harbour in Europe, even though it was the music industry that lobbied hard for this. And I thought it was interesting that one of the reasons why this film company in Germany sued TikTok and was using the evolved safe harbour as part of their case was because people are uploading their content, the films that they distribute to TikTok without licence, without permission, and it's damaging the YouTube channels they operate. So they went legal to protect their YouTube business.
It's all come full circle.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about this today, but if you're interested why that case is relevant, why it's possibly important, but also why it's possibly less important for the music industry in 2024, do go and check out the full article on the website. But the only reason I mention it here really is I got to write about Safe Harbour again for the first time in several years.
Bit of nostalgia.
I used to write about the Safe Harbour 6,000 words every day, I think. I mean, maybe I'm remembering that slightly exaggerated. So that was one thing that happened this week, but not the thing we're here to talk about.
No, later on we'll be talking through more of this week's most interesting music industry stories, including the latest calls for support for UK nightclubs and grassroots music venues as closures continue. But first, there have been questions this week over the politicisation of arts funding. Northern Irish rap group NECAP has said that they plan to sue the UK government after Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch blocked funding awarded to them through the Music Export Growth Scheme because of the politics of their music. Meanwhile, Arts Council England has responded to criticism of updates it made to its policies around reputation risk, which includes guidance on political statements made in a personal capacity by people who work with or for funded arts organisations.
Yes, so there's two elements to this story to talk about, but let's start with the first one first. That seems like a sensible thing. So Kneecap, Belfast-based hip-hop group who perform in both Irish and English, and often in their output refer to their support for a united Ireland. They have frequently courted controversy with their music and their other creative output, sometimes because of their politics, sometimes because they're quite sweary in their lyrics, sometimes because of the drugs references in their lyrics. So they've courted controversy in various different ways. When criticised by different people, whether that's politicians or journalists or whatever, they have generally argued that art should be challenging. Of course, they're right on that, although they have also insisted that quite a lot of their output is meant to be taken tongue-in-cheek. There's a lot of playfulness and a lot of fun and crack, they told the BBC last month. If you're offended by it, you're just not getting the joke.
Now, for listeners outside the UK, and also, I suspect, some within it, we should probably give a bit broader background to this. But I'm going to try to make this quick because we could get very deep into this very quickly. So the UK, do we need to explain? I think we're going to have to explain this just to make sure everyone's on the same page.
We live in a country of countries, everybody, and Andy is now going to explain that to you.
Yes. I think people do find this confusing because it is stupid and confusing. Anyway, so the UK consists of four countries: England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Now, there was a time when the whole of the island of Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, but then the Republic of Ireland became an independent country. However, the area we call Northern Ireland stayed within the UK, and not everyone living in the north approved of that arrangement, which resulted in a period of history euphemistically referred to as the Troubles. Things changed in the 1990s with the Good Friday Agreement, although political tensions remain. But for various reasons, the chances of Northern Ireland leaving the UK and creating a united Ireland in the relatively near future do seem to have increased, although that remains politically controversial both within Northern Ireland and the wider UK. And that is a very, very brief and I hope understandable history of the United Kingdom and the situation in Northern Ireland, of which there has been quite a lot of glossing done. But, you know, this is, I don't think this is the place to get your historical knowledge from. It's not what we offer. So
there are history podcasts aplenty.
Yeah. Don't blame me if you are not now up to speed. I did try. But anyway, that's a little bit of background. And now it brings us back to this whole thing with the Music Export Growth Scheme, or MEGS, and Kneecap.
And having forced Andy to do 100 years of Irish history in a few sentences, I'm now taking responsibility for telling you what MEGS is all about, which is a lot easier.
Well, you've got the hard job.
So MEGS is a UK government-funded programme that exists to support independent artists and labels who are pursuing opportunities in new markets. So it's funding that is available to artists and indie labels who've had some success here in the UK and see opportunities in other countries around the world and need a little bit of help to pursue those opportunities. And although the money for MEGS comes from the UK government, it's actually administered by the record industry trade group BPI, who have a committee of music industry representatives who get all of the bids for MEGS funding and decide which bands and which labels deserve the support in order to pursue those opportunities. Now, Kneecap's bid for funding from MEGS was approved by that industry committee. So they should have been getting a bit of cash to help them pursue some opportunities abroad. However, because this is government money that is being dished out to support artists, each grant has to be rubber stamped by Badnock and her team at the UK government's Department for Business and Trade. And with this grant, the rubber stamping did not happen, and confirming that the department had indeed intervened on this, a spokesperson for the minister subsequently told reporters that they had blocked the grant because, and I quote, they did not want to hand taxpayers' money to people that oppose the United Kingdom itself.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are quite a lot of UK taxpayers in Northern Ireland, not to mention Scotland, Wales, and I would wager even England, who could be said to oppose the United Kingdom itself. So I don't know how good an argument that really is. I mean, you can't say that just because you pay tax in the United Kingdom, you wouldn't like to see at least some of the countries become independent. I don't know. Anyway, I would say that maybe representing different views isn't a bad thing. Who am I? I'm just a neutral voice in this thing explaining what's happened. Don't write me letters. A spokesperson for the BPI said that the organisation was disappointed by the decision, adding that while it is for government to speak to its rationale for making this particular decision, we firmly believe in the importance of freedom of expression, including artistic expression, and look forward to discussing further with government how any decisions involving potential controversial matters will be handled in future.
So once it became clear that the UK government had intervened to block this funding for NECAP, this story became both legal and political. First of all, the band confirmed that they'd hired lawyers based in Belfast to sue the Department for Business and Trade, arguing that this intervention was actually illegal. So that will be interesting to follow if that litigation proceeds. Meanwhile, back in Northern Ireland, an MP who is based there called Colm Eastwood, he raised the matter formally in the Westminster Parliament in UK, stating that the move could be a breach of the Good Friday Agreement, which was signed as part of the Northern Ireland peace process back in 1998. The agreement, he said, includes a commitment to exercise power on the basis of parity of esteem between communities in the north. He then continued in a statement, it would be unacceptable if the British government had instituted a policy of defunding groups because they support Irish unity. Art is meant to be challenging, he went on, obviously agreeing with NECAP, who had said that themselves earlier. You don't have to agree with an artist or group to understand the importance of funding creators who challenge the status quo and the establishment. I have submitted a number of parliamentary questions to establish what has happened here.
Now, also this week, Art Council England issued a statement about a recent update to its relationship framework policies that amends guidance for organisations it funds around reputation risk. That, the updated policy states, includes the reputation risk of political statements made, and I quote, not just by the organisation and its decisions, but also by staff and other individuals associated with the organisation acting in a personal capacity. Now, many in the creative community have argued that this new guidance, and especially the reference to individuals speaking out in a personal capacity, is a restriction of free speech. And in this guidance, there is a list of things that might cause reputation concerns, including activity that might be considered overtly political or activist and goes beyond your company's core purpose, and partnerships with organisations that might be perceived as being in conflict with the purposes of public funding of culture.
So this update to the Arts Council's policies actually happened last month, but it got picked up by the media this week. And as a result of that, a big debate erupted on social media accusing the Arts Council of interfering with freedom of expression and free speech, even though actually in the same policy document, the Arts Council talks quite a lot about the importance of freedom of expression. So in response to that online debate and seeking to counter its critics, the Arts Council said in a statement that the guidance does not seek to stop any artist or organisation from making the art they want to make or speaking out in any way they wish, including in ways that challenge institutions and authorities. The guidance, they said, sets out a series of steps for organisations to go through to ensure that if they or people associated with them are planning activity that might be viewed as controversial, they have thought through and so far as possible mitigated the risk to themselves and crucially to their staff and to the communities they serve.
So basically, you can be controversial so long as you've done a comprehensive risk assessment and really thought long and hard about whether or not being controversial might actually, just possibly, turn out to be a bit controversial. The Arts Council statement concluded, the intention of the refreshed relationship framework is not to prevent individuals from expressing their political views, but to support artists and organisations with tools to ensure that this is done in such a way that it does not result in unintended consequences or distress for others associated with the organisation.
So two interesting stories there, questioning whether or not you have full freedom of expression in your art, if you're accepting funding. I think the Arts Council would say you definitely do with Arts Council funding, with the Music Export Growth Scheme. Well, that's a story we're going to follow closely.
Coming Coming up later, the legal battle over royalties that is brewing between MLC and Pandora. But before that, some other stories from the music industry this week. Firstly, tributes have poured in for long-standing BBC radio presenter Steve Wright, who died this week, aged 69. He joined Radio 1 in 1980 and was a popular fixture on the station until the 90s. He later moved to Radio 2, where he continued to present shows up until his death.
Elsewhere, an agreement has been reached between the English National Opera and the Musicians' Union over cutbacks to its orchestra. The MU says that although it has secured an improved deal for its members in that orchestra, the changes to the working terms of those musicians still remain significant, and its members accepted the new agreement with heavy hearts. The changes at E&O were announced last year and are basically the result of changes to the way it is funded by the Arts Council.
The UK's Nighttime Industries Association has again called for government support for the clubbing sector after revealing that nearly 400 clubs have closed since the start of the pandemic. More recently, the cost of living crisis and changes in student socialising are putting the sector under pressure.
Similarly, the Music Venue Trust has also again called for more support for the grassroots alive sector from both industry, but if industry won't do it, from government and politicians as well. They're still pushing for there to be a ticket levy on large-scale shows to create funds that can support everything happening at the grassroots. And that latest call for support was made as Nottingham's Chameleon became the latest UK grassroots venue to announce it is closing.
Now, if you want to read more about any of those stories or indeed anything we've discussed this week, you can find links in the show notes or at completemusicupdate.com. And finally, on this edition of Setlist, US Collecting Society, the MLC, has said that Pandora really should start paying mechanical royalties on all music played by users on its free tier. And it wasn't just musing about this while rocking in a chair somewhere. This is the thrust of a new lawsuit it has filed against Pandora in the Nashville courts. The MLC accuses Pandora of underpaying royalties, with its CEO Chris Arend adding, "Our team repeatedly sought to resolve this issue directly with Pandora, but Pandora has refused to correct their reporting or royalty payments."
Now, this dispute between the MLC, which is the American Mechanical Rights Collecting Society, and SiriusXM-owned Pandora, centres on how we define personalised radio, which, of course, Pandora at its heart is a personalised radio service. How are we defining that in copyright terms? And what we're really interested in is when we provide music through a personalised radio service rather than an on-demand service like Spotify, are we exploiting both the mechanical rights and the performing rights of the song copyright, or just the performing rights? So that's basically what is at the heart of this dispute. Just to give you a little bit of background, traditionally, radio broadcasters only needed a license covering the performing rights in songs in order to use music, because with classic radio, DJs would come into the studio, they would play records and CDs, and then that would go out through a transmitter over the air to listeners. And crucially, in that process, no copying of music took place, because it's when music is copied that the so-called mechanical rights are being exploited. In some cases, as radio shifted online, the music industry has accepted that online radio also only exploits the performing rights, not the mechanical rights, including sometimes personalised radio. Now, quite how things work and quite what licences online radio and personalised radio stations need, the rules sort of differ from country to country, sometimes because of industry convention more than copyright law. But in the US, the mechanical rights in songs are covered by a compulsory licence, and it's that compulsory licence which the MLC administrates. So we have a compulsory licence that sort of provides some relevant rules as to when the mechanical rights are or are not being exploited. And in the license, a big distinction is made between interactive and non-interactive online services, basically saying that if you are running an interactive online music service, then mechanical rights are being exploited. You need a license, and you get that through the MLC.
Yeah, and with personalized radio, which, as you say, is the core of Pandora's product, it's generally understood that if a user gets a curated stream of music but can't pick specific tracks or albums on demand, then that falls under the non-interactive bracket and there's no mechanical rights license required. Under Pandora's premium subscription plans, which do pay out the MLC, users can skip and replay songs on demand without any limits. But on Pandora Free, which is its ad-supported service, users get a limited number of skips per day, but may be given the option to unlock more skips by engaging with an advert. Also, those listeners will be prompted to watch a video ad when they want to replay a track. And the marketing blurb for all this makes a point of saying that this is so that users can search and play what they want.
Now, that extra functionality on the free tier, the MLC reckons, means that Pandora Free is actually an interactive service, not a non-interactive service, and therefore mechanical royalties are due. Now, Pandora does actually acknowledge that when those extra bits of functionality are being used by subscribers on the free tier, yes, that is now interactive and therefore mechanical royalties need to be paid through the compulsory license, through the MLC. However, what Pandora is saying is while the free user is just using the basic curated service, they're not actually employing those extra interactive tools, then it's non-interactive. So most of Pandora Free is non-interactive, but some of it is interactive. So, according to Pandora, it should only have to pay mechanical royalties to MLC for some of the usage of music on the free tier, for some of the revenue that flows through on the free tier, not for all of it.
As a result of that, the MLC lawsuit explains, Pandora has excluded revenue derived from non-interactive services on the Pandora Free configuration because it believes those elements are beyond the scope of the compulsory license. Even though, the MLC adds, Pandora has admitted that it increased the on-demand functionality of its free service in order to compete with the likes of Spotify, which obviously offer more interactivity. And Spotify does pay mechanical royalties on its entire free tier.
Yeah, so basically MLC are saying, okay, there are non-interactive and interactive elements to your free service, but because the user at any time can activate the interactive elements, just like on Spotify, the entire service should be paying mechanical royalties. Pay up is what the MLC are saying. And apparently, according to the lawsuit, when they sent a letter to Pandora saying, we think you've got this wrong, you owe us more money, Pandora basically said, we disagree, unsurprisingly. Your interpretation of copyright law is wrong, said Pandora. Actually, they even questioned whether or not the MLC is empowered under law to be making decisions on what is interactive or non-interactive. But I think the MLC reckons it can make that decision. But anyway, this is now going to court. A court of law can definitely make that decision if this gets that far. As always, they'll probably settle. But nevertheless, an interesting development. We love a little bit of litigation happening with Pandora and the MLC over in the US.
But that's all we've got time for on this week's setlist. We will be back with another episode next week, and you can keep up with all the latest music industry news every day at completemusicupdate.com.